U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
All 50 states have now moved to reopen. The Justice Department warns California about its lockdown on churches, plus another twist in the Michael Flynn case. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal, sitting in today for Paul Jugot. We are joined today by my colleague, Bill McGurn. Hi, Bill, just the two of us today.
Hi, Kyle.
Some parts of the country are still tighter than others, of course, but every state has moved, at least in some way, to reopen its economy, its public spaces, its private spaces. In New Jersey, you can go play golf. In Michigan, construction sites are back up to work, building whatever they're building. Some states are acting statewide. Some are acting just on a regional basis. So certain areas that have been less hard hit are open. But it seems like in many places, life is slowly beginning to return to its normal rhythms and activities, even if they're socially distanced and not exactly being undertaken in the way they were before.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's a smart way to do it. Look, the circumstances vary. You know, some of the universities have now announced, like Notre Dame, they're going to open in the fall, but they've adjusted. They're going to open 2 or 3 weeks early and get out earlier. You know, it depends on where you are. If you're in Iowa, the situation might be very different than if you're in Manhattan or even New Jersey. So I think this is the one of the advantages of a federal system where local authorities can adapt to general directives and smart measures to local circumstances.
Yeah, and it's some of the worst case scenarios, at least so far, have not played out. So it's been not quite a month since Georgia's high profile reopening. On April 24th, I believe it was, the governor there, Brian Kemp, said that barbershops could reopen, tattoo parlors, bowling alleys and such. And he took a lot of criticism for that decision. Even President Trump, if you remember, said that he strongly disagreed with it. There was a little brouhaha there. But we're almost a month later, and I'm looking at the graph of new cases reported so far in Georgia, and it's still trending downward. I mean, a little bit of up and down here and there, but the trend is definitely down. And maybe the spike is yet to come, who knows, but at least so far, it's not visible. It's not obvious that this reopening was a bad move for Georgia yet.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think the general measure is if there were going to be a spike from an action, it would be 2 or 3 weeks after the action was taken. So we're kind of right at that point now. I'm not sure we're quite 3 weeks. We're close to it, if not. And we haven't seen it. And that's what other people are going to be looking at. Look, one of the problems is there's a fierce debate over whether the steps we've taken are actually accomplishing, you know, what we were told they were going to do. For example, in New Jersey, Governor Murphy just announced, several stages to full reopening. And he said that latter won't come until we have a vaccine. Well, that could be a long time from now. And when he first imposed these measures, he didn't say anything about a vaccine. He talked about flattening the curve to prevent our hospitals and health services from being overwhelmed. And now it seems like some of these people are doing a switcheroo, changing the reasons to keep a lockdown. I think what we're going to see going ahead is more division. Some governors keeping strict controls in place and others opening up. I do think the pressure will be on the people who haven't opened up to do so if the ones who do seem to be able to have opened up without a big explosion of cases and deaths.
I'm starting to wonder how fast these partial openings in various states, though, will help revitalize the economy. I mean, the restaurant business, just to take one example, is a tough business to be in, even in normal times. And if you're operating under an order that says you can only be at half capacity or something like that, I mean, that is really rough. And especially when you'll have a lot of citizens, residents who, even if they're allowed to go in a restaurant, don't quite feel comfortable doing that yet. For its part, I mean, the stock market has really rallied in recent days. So investors seem to think we're on the way up, but the economic numbers are a little alarming. I mean, over 8 weeks, we have now 36.5 million Americans about who have filed for unemployment insurance. That is a mind-bending number. The Paycheck Protection Program has not run out of funding a second time. Which I think is interesting. I mean, remember the first $350 billion went very fast. Then Congress added another $310 billion to that. And some of that money is still sitting in the pot. So, I mean, on one hand, maybe some companies are getting back to work or a good portion of the demand for that program is satisfied. On the other hand, it seems like there are some issues with the requirements. Some companies have returned the money. They're worried about the rule that says they have to spend 75% of it on payroll if they're in an area where, you know, rent is high. I mean, it will just be very interesting to see what the numbers look like going forward.
Yeah, absolutely, Kyle. Look, I think the point about the relief there is that it's done some good for some people to get, you know, to get, it's the only income they have coming in. But I think the problem is it can't be a substitute for a functioning economy. You and I both live in a suburban town in New Jersey, and I was walking along the main street, picking up takeout from one of the restaurants, and it just amazed me at all these shops that are closed. And what can you do when there's no revenue coming in? You know, printing paper and, you know, money is just a temporary bridge. There's no substitute for getting the economy functioning and getting people back to work. And that's one of the interesting things about the economic problem. We don't need to stimulate the demand. The demand was there. It's the supply that's been cut off because, you know, people are stopping work. And I think you're seeing this kind of burst out at the seams. People are not going to stay locked down forever. And I wonder if they had to impose a second lockdown. I'm just wondering how successful it would be, because I think people also are not confident that what the health officials are telling them is actually effective. It looks like that they don't know. And so I think there's a lot of people losing confidence in these lockdown measures.
Or the liability issue, too. I mean, Right. They're not confident that if they reopen while following the best guidance at the time, that they're not going to be sued or dinged for it later. I mean, on that end, President Trump was trying to provide some reassurance on Tuesday. He signed an executive order at a cabinet meeting, and there are a couple parts to it. But one of them is suggesting that agencies should decline enforcement when enforcement actions against businesses, companies, when they have attempted in reasonable good faith, it says, to follow the regulations they're supposed to, or to follow CDC guidelines, Centers for Disease Control guidelines on the health issues. The point there being to give businesses some confidence, a little bit of confidence, that if they reopen, they won't be dinged for it later if they followed CDC guidelines and missed some OSHA guidelines or something like that. Another interesting part of that executive order is it tells agencies to go hunting for regulations that can be eased or eliminated to help the economy. And then it also tells them to review about 600 rule changes or waivers that they've done to aid with the pandemic. I mean, there are a lot of FDA rule changes. There was some emergency flexibility given to truckers carrying goods. And some of those waivers may not be able to be made permanent without acts of Congress. So, I mean, the telehealth ones I've looked at a little bit, and Medicare patients previously had very restricted limits on telehealth, and now they can use their iPhone from their couch and, you know, talk to their doctor. And that's something that can't be extended, as far as I understand it, without Congress's help. But there's other regulations that could be. So another one of the waivers, the guidance that was issued is saying that if you want to talk to your doctor on FaceTime, Apple FaceTime or Skype, these consumer services, those might not qualify under privacy rules, security rules. But for this pandemic, people are being allowed to do that. And, you know, if people are FaceTiming their doctors and there haven't been any issues, I mean, that might be something that the agencies could keep permanently then.
I hope so. Look, those two things you spoke of all come under the broad rubric of what I was glad to see the president say, that his directive is that we fight the economic consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic as much as we're fighting the disease itself, because this is the key to people recovering. I mean, people sometimes paint this as saving lives over saving the economy. And I think that's such a false comparison, because you cannot save lives and not save the economy. If we don't have an economy, a lot of people are going to be hurting. I think in the, underneath this rubric, the deregulation aspect is, we now live in such a high tech world. Look, all these a lot of people like us have moved home and found we can adapt and do our jobs from home. All sorts of people are finding innovative ways to adapt, and the key to the less pain and moving to the future is flexibility. And a lot of those regulations were written for a very different time and impose limits that don't make sense. A lot of these limits on providing medical services, for example, that just don't make sense in our age. So I think the president is right to focus on that. And the liability issue is, I mean, it should be a no-brainer. These businesses are already losing massive amounts of revenue. A lot of them have laid off people. If they want to bring them back, they don't want to get hit, as you say, on the other end by then being punished for a good faith effort to reemploy people amid smart conditions. If they're, you know, if they're flouting all the health restrictions, that's one thing. But if they're following the guidelines in good faith, it seems just only common sense to immunize them from these kind of claims. Otherwise, why would you reopen that way? The risks are enormous.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. There is some friction still over the state lockdowns, particularly when it comes to religious liberty. There have been a few of these cases now. The Justice Department intervened in one in Virginia, I believe. There was a ruling from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals on a lockdown in Kentucky. And then on Tuesday, the Justice Department sent a letter to California Governor Gavin Newsom about his lockdown. And the argument essentially, as I understand it, is over who is deemed an essential worker. If there is a worker in e-commerce, for instance, and it's decided that telework is not practical, then they're allowed to go to their workplace. And religious institutions are not given, churches are not given that same freedom. And so the letter to the governor of California says, quote, simply put, there is no pandemic exception to the U.S. Constitution and its Bill of Rights, unquote. I'm not sure, I haven't seen a response yet from California. But Bill, it is interesting that there have been so many of these cases, either playing out in public or percolating in the court system.
Yeah, look, this one I think is actually a no-brainer. Most of the complaints, look, a lot of religious people really resent the idea that a marijuana shop could be essential services and a church would not. I think the issue in most cases comes down to discrimination, not essential or non-essential. A lot of it comes down to discrimination in this sense. I remember there was a church, I believe, in Missouri early on near Easter. It's either Easter or Palm Sunday. And the congregants came in cars and they parked with their windows rolled up and so forth in their cars to listen to their pastor who was sermonizing on FM radio broadcaster. So no one's in touch. And a lot of these people got cited. Meanwhile, other restaurants like drive-in restaurants with the windows open and stuff, people get there, were allowed to conduct their businesses. You know, that led Attorney General Bill Barr to issue a letter trying to sort out some of this. And he warned that there's no pandemic exemption from the Constitution. The First Amendment still applies. You have emergency measures, but the point is you can't discriminate between a church and, you know, if the church is following the rules, if they can socially distance in the church, as many of them can, and they allow others to do that, it's going to be very hard to justify discriminating against the churches. And I think this is going to come to a head because some of the governors seem to have it out for the churches. I don't know why. And I think it'd be a lot easier to try to let them reopen or open, within the limits of CDC guidelines and so forth. If they were applying these guidelines equally, the churches would have no case. But I think they're not applying them equally.
Meanwhile, states are moving to figure out how to hold either primary elections, if they still have primary elections this year, or voting in November. And there's been some more movement on that. California, I believe, has said it's now going to send registered voters an absentee ballot. And Michigan, the most recent one, says it will mail an absentee ballot application to every registered voter in the state, about 7.7 million people. And, I can understand that move, though. I do worry that trying a mass vote by mail experiment could be a lot messier than some of the advocates are thinking at this moment. And I'll raise a couple of things. The first one is rejected ballots. So in 2016, if you look at a report by the Election Assistance Commission, it says about 1% of submitted absentee ballots in 2016 were rejected. And most of the time, that's because you're supposed to sign the back of the absentee ballot and you forgot to sign it, or you signed it and your signature doesn't match whatever signature the state has on file, whether that's from previous voting or registration or your driver's license. And election officials go through and look at them and try to make sure they match and doesn't match, or the ballots arrived late. So in 2016, I mean, we're talking about 320,000 votes, roughly, that were thrown out. And as some of these states move to mass mail voting, one of the things that I think is worth worrying about is that you'll particularly have a lot of new people who've never voted by mail. And so the percentage of rejected ballots will go out. And you could end up with a situation where the Electoral College is decided, for instance, by Michigan, and the two candidates are separated by, a few thousand votes, and far more votes than that have been thrown out, which to me, Bill, just sounds like it is a recipe for a year 2000 Florida like fiasco.
Absolutely. I think the mail-in votes are going to be a huge problem for that reason. It's a bad idea. And if we think that we've had troubles now with electronic counting, when we get this mail ballots, it could be a nightmare at all these places. Look, I understand the need for a backup system and so forth, but I wouldn't so eagerly move to it this quickly. The circumstances may be very different in November. And I would like to think there are other mechanisms for safe voting than just mail. I mean, look at the primary votes, the problems that Democrats had. If you put this in the general election, we're not going to know results, for months after. And I don't think we want to go through that.
Yeah. And then the second issue I would raise is what is sometimes called ballot harvesting. This has made news, particularly in California, which changed its law around this not too long ago. But essentially, the idea is that activists, sometimes paid activists, can go around, door to door even, and collect absentee ballots and say, hey, you were mailed an absentee ballot. I can take that back to the registrar for you. And in Orange County, the officials said that they had people dropping off maybe 100 or 200 ballots at a time. And this has not been widespread outside of California. But what's interesting is if you start to poke around and look into it, there are other states that don't really deal with the question in their laws. And one of them is the noted battleground state of Wisconsin. There is no law against ballot harvesting in Wisconsin. An absentee voter can designate anybody really to return his or her ballot. There are not significant limits on that. So while there's no, you know, I haven't seen any reports that it's been happening yet, that is certainly a risk if these states start moving, you know, pushing voters and getting to, say, a majority of people voting by mail. It's certainly a risk if that would start happening.
It's very much risk, and I think it would be a quick reality. Look, anytime you deviate from, you know, from the system you have, you just open the door to being manipulated by people who figure out the weaknesses of the new system. And the paper ballots, as opposed to people going in person and submitting an ID, it just creates so many opportunities for mischief. It's hard to believe that some people won't take advantage of that.
Yeah, and I mean, there was one example of that in North Carolina in 2018, where an election consultant got in trouble for doing this, essentially, which is against North Carolina law. But even if you rule out the idea of intentional fraud, it seems like there's a huge problem here. And then finally, there's a new filing in the Michael Flynn case. Bill, you've looked at that. What's the story there?
Yeah, I mean, there's you know, it's a complicated case. The general has tried to withdraw his guilty plea. That's been held up for court in some while. And the Justice Department supported that, said that the case should be dropped because on reconsideration of the evidence, they don't believe that they have the evidence that Michael Flynn did anything wrong and are not confident they could prove it. So normally that would be the end of it. But this judge is invited. So he has the, you know, judge's job is to adjudicate between the defense and the prosecution, the parties in the case. He's gone outside by appointing another former judge, clearly a member of the Trump resistance by his op-eds and so forth, to analyze and wonder and write up why there shouldn't be a move against Michael Flynn to charge him with contempt for perjury. This is just outrageous. And now what you're talking about is General Flynn's attorney, Sidney Powell, who has been tremendous, has filed a motion for a writ of mandamus from the appeals court. And basically, she wants to take the case away from the district judge, Emmett Sullivan, because she says he's biased. You know, he wondered aloud in court whether the general should be charged with treason when there was no evidence for it. I think he also said he was disgusted by the general and that he had, you know, sold out his country. All these wild things. So writ of mandamus to force a judge to do something he doesn't want or take it away from him is very rare. It's very hard to prove. But if this case doesn't prove it, with all the nefarious efforts to convict this man, and now we have both the defense and the prosecution agreeing there's no there. I think actually what she's done by this filing, and it's very aggressive, and it minces no words about the judge or the Justice Department or the FBI. It's worth reading. But I think what she's also saying is that the credibility of the court system is on trial here, too. If General Flynn cannot get justice from an impartial judge, we're in a lot of trouble.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.